Good morning, good afternoon, or good evening, my fine friends. Welcome to the second episode of the 10th season of the Tom Petty Project podcast. I'm your host, Kevin Brown. This is the weekly podcast that digs into the entire Tom Petty catalogue, song by song, album by album, and includes conversations with musicians, fans, and people connected with Tom along the way. Before we head over to social media to take a look through your thoughts on Wildflowers and episode one, and in case you haven't seen my news from the weekend yet, I wanted to let you all know that I'll finally get to meet some of you down in Gainesville this year. The wonderful Dan Spice and I had been chatting last year about the possibility of me going down to Gainesville to the Tom Petty weekend to be involved in some way, but it just didn't work out last year. The stars have aligned in 2024, though, and I'll be joining the celebration both as a very eager spectator, but also as a part of the program in some way. We're not 100% sure what that looks like yet or what my participation will be exactly, but once we do know, I'll make sure all of you know too. And I can't wait to just walk around the town Tom grew up in, to be honest. You know, hey, maybe I'll pick up some Black Diamond guitar strings while I'm down there, even though I won't be able to pick them up at Lillian's music store. I'm excited to go see the house that Tom grew up in, to see Blake Harrison's fantastic mural, and generally just soak up all that southern atmosphere. And aside from finally seeing some artists perform live, who I've been listening to for a bunch of years now, what I'm most looking forward to is meeting a whole bunch of Tom Petty fans, including, hopefully, quite a few of you. Quite a few of you have reached out already to say that you're going, so it will be fantastic to put some faces to names that I've known, you know, for the past couple and a half years. It's going to be so much fun. So as I say, once we figure out the details of my participation, I'll make sure you guys know that, and I'll definitely be live streaming a little from the event, as well as recording and publishing podcast episodes after each day's revelry. Okay, on to last week's episode, Wildflowers. Over on Instagram, ratings guesser extraordinaire Lisa Kelly Pennington commented, "Okay, I didn't really expect anything else even without listening to the episode, so 1-0. Although if you had said anything other than a 10, I might have boycotted the entire season. I'm digging the piano." And I've mentioned this before, but Lisa always tries to guess my rating for each song and lets me know how she's doing season to season, which is a ton of fun. And thanks, Lisa, for mentioning the piano too. I can't remember whether I talked about this before, but for the kickoff episode, as a very last-minute decision, I thought I'd replace the usual, you know, the pro-level musical snippets that my friend Randy does with solo piano parts that I learned and recorded at around midnight the night that I was editing that episode. I think they have sort of an earthy spontaneousness about them that works quite well, so I think I'll keep them more or less for this season. On Twitter, Steve Ursell, who is a fellow Manchester United fan, unlike that knave of a Liverpool fan, John Paulson, said, "It's a really beautiful and moving song. I think he's mainly talking to a partner he is separating from, but I agree there is an element of addressing himself too. I love the kindness in the song and the idea of finding freedom in nature, whether among the flowers or at sea." And I love that Steve uses the word kindness here. It's not something I would have thought to remark on, but in the context of Tom singing this to another person, it's the perfect noun to use. Over on Facebook, Dallas Helica commented on my conversation with Mary Beth Donnelly, saying, "Great conversation, completely spot on about the underlying themes running through a lot of his songs. I hadn't focused on that before so specifically." And I'd remarked in my reply to that that this is the greatest joy of doing this podcast. Hearing other people's takes on the songs, themes, and Tom's music in general is always thought-provoking and almost always educational. And I do take the position that any opinion is valid if it's considered and well-stated. It's what makes art so personal and important to all of us. Lisa Marshall writes, "I love the album version, in brackets, whole album, for all the reasons that you are or will point out, but home recordings, aka do-do-do version, would be my desert island song. One take, just fell out perfect in every way, untouched, raw, meaningful lyrics, and makes me smile until I cry because it is that good." And this is another thing about Tom's music and the nature of him having given us so much fantastic live material and all these alternate versions of certain tracks, especially on this album. We can even have a discussion about which version of the same song we prefer, not just whether we like the song itself. Nora Hayward Olson commented, "Wonderful podcast as usual, Kevin. Just as TP set the tone for the album with the opener title song, you did the same with the show." Thanks, Nora. Really appreciate that. "While I love all the different levels of maturity in Tom's voice, I think he is at his peak vocally on Wildflowers, album and song. The nasally undertones of his younger days are not as strong." And then she says, "I wonder if this had something to do with his tonsillectomy. And he hadn't yet reached his more grizzled sounding period. He could reach the higher notes without sounding like he was stretching too much." And I've always felt that usually around 35 to 45 is when most singers of Tom's, you know, general type, and though that's a discussion all of its own, I think that's when they tend to hit their peak. So you think about Jackson Browne, you think about Springsteen, you think about Tom, that sort of 35 to 45 range when their voice is mellowed just that little bit, I think that's when they're at their prime. And there's a confidence and surety in Tom's vocal that runs through this entire record, and I'd agree that his tone is basically perfect. Finally, my associate producer Paul Roberts has a little fun, saying, "Great pod, Kev. I know you wanted to do justice to Wildflowers, and I think you've succeeded on all levels." Thanks again. Thanks so much, Paul. The track is, as you say, 10 out of 10 material. I enjoy how, to the casual listener, it is a basic acoustic track, but on further examination, lots of other parts come forth. Next week is definitely another, in quotes, drug track. Agree to disagree on Learning to Fly and Mary Jane's Last Dance. Wonder if you'll come up with another explanation. Well, Paul, as I said to you on Facebook, I don't know whether I could argue against this week's song containing a reference to marijuana. Or could I? Okay, let me take a run at this. In England, as you know, mate, a joint is also slang for someone's home. And the verb to roll can also mean to rob. So, if I were in a mood to be facetious or contentious, I could say that, "Let me run with you tonight, I'll take you on a moonlight ride. There's someone I used to see, but she don't give a damn for me. But let me get to the point, let's roll another joint." Well, it could be Tom saying to an accomplice that they're heading over to an ex-girlfriend's house to rob her in the middle of the night. Well, it's not, but A for effort, maybe, Paul? A for effort? Come on. Well, that's enough of that anyway. It's probably time to start diving into today's song, isn't it? You could almost say it's time to get to the point. So let's do that and chat some about Tom's first single from the album, You Don't Know How It Feels. The first thing to note with You Don't Know How It Feels, as I said, it's the lead single from the album, or you should really probably say it's the first single. It's fairly typical for the first single to come out ahead of the album, to lead the album, to whet the appetite and to build some anticipation for the new record. This was certainly the case in Tom's discography from Hard Promises on. The single would usually come out a week or two before the album. In the case of Wildflowers, though, You Don't Know How It Feels was released on December 3rd, 1994, a full 32 days after the album had been released. I don't know if there's a significance to this strategy because after this album, Tom returned to the more typical sequencing for the first single leading the release of the album. The meaning I infer here is that the emphasis with this release was on the album as a whole rather than it being single oriented. I think Tom wanted people to buy the record and listen to it as a whole before releasing any individual song from it. And I did try to do some digging, but it's really hard to find numbers on radio play for album tracks, as I'd be really curious to know which tracks got the most airplay before the album was released. I'd guess that today's song, the title track, and You Wreck Me, maybe, would have been the ones that immediately would have hit the airwaves. But hey, you know what? If you remember, this album coming out and hearing the songs before any of the singles were released, do let me know which songs were the most commonly played on the radio. You Don't Know How It Feels would go on to be Tom's last number one on the US rock chart, and inexplicably, to me at least, his last top 20 hit on the Billboard Hot 100. The song went to number 3 on the chart up here in Canada and was also a live staple from 1994 onward, being performed a documented 413 times, including on every date of the 40th anniversary tour in 2017. Now, for all I've commented over the last couple of weeks that there was no eye on writing a hit single during these sessions, this track is the exception that proves the rule. In the liner notes to Wildflowers and All the Rest, Mike Campbell remarks that it was a conscious effort of Rick saying, "We need to write a hit." You know what sounds like a hit is that Steve Miller song, The Joker. Maybe write something to that beat, and Tom came back with this. Rubin goes on to say, "It's not uncommon to start with a flavor to get started. Then the new song evolves to become whatever it wants to be." And when you hear it explicitly stated, you think, oh yeah, the beat and tempo are fairly similar to The Joker. But when you actually listen to them side by side, they're distinctly different in a couple of important ways. First of all, You Don't Know How It Feels is almost 10 beats per minute slower, which gives the groove a much, much lazier feel. There's also the lack of fills and embellishments that adorn Steve Miller's 1973 hit. So, let's use the drums as a starting point, because they are the bedrock of this track and mark an important transition within the Heartbreakers rhythm section. At this point, Stan Lynch had left the band for good. He didn't like the material that would become Wildflowers, and his relationship with the band, and Tom in particular, had deteriorated to a point of no return. With Lynch's ferocity and manic energy a seemingly poor fit for the set of songs Tom had in mind for the album, new drummers were brought in to see if they were a better fit. Among those drummers were, of course, Ringo Starr, who ended up playing on three tracks, one of which was included on the eventual album, and other luminaries of the drum kit included Russ Kunkel, who had backed contemporaries like Jackson Brown, Bob Seger, Bob Dylan, and Stevie Nicks, and Kenny Aronoff, the legendary session drummer who had worked with the likes of Mellencamp, Springsteen, and John Fogerty. Anyone else a fan of that beaten Jack and Diane? That's Kenny Aronoff. Aronoff's work in the sessions was released among the tracks on Finding Wildflowers, which was included as a standalone release. He provides the drum track on the studio version of Driving Down to Georgia. However, none of these amazing musicians were exactly the right fit. In a 2007 interview, assistant engineer at Sound City, Joe Barresi, recalled other drummers passing through the session saying, but when they got Steve Ferroni, that was it. Ferroni had already worked with Mike Campbell in the backing band for a benefit gig that George Harrison had played at the Royal Albert Hall. Of his audition, and I put that word in quotes, Steve told Music Radar in 2010, I'm pretty sure that George recommended me for the gig. So we started to play You Don't Know How It Feels, and that felt pretty good. Then we listened back to what we played, and Tom said, wow, what a difference a drummer makes. Then he turned to me and said, don't worry, Steve, you've won. And that was it. I know a lot of people will maybe raise an eyebrow to hear that this song is the one that convinced Tom that Steve was his guy. It's not a complex drum part. In fact, on first glance, it sounds like anyone can play it. And that's more or less true. Anyone can play the notes, but to do it with the metronomic timing, tempo, and feel that Steve Ferroni does, that's an entirely different matter. The drum beat in You Don't Know How It Feels defines the song every bit as much as the harmonica or Tom's iconic lines in the chorus. But finding a drummer that can hear the song and instinctively know exactly what part to play and then do it almost flawlessly first take is a pretty rare thing. The song opens with a faded in guitar that's been routed through a magnetone amp, giving it an unusual sound before those magnificent drums come in. Bum bum cha, bum bum cha. It's We Will Rock You without the bombast. It's the Joker with an added layer of grease. Over the top, adding to the sleaze, is Tom's simple yet instantly recognisable harmonica line. No noodling guitars, just a really simple harmonica playing lead over drums and bass, with just a little hint of acoustic guitar thrown in. Bass guitar on this track is provided by Tom, who also plays acoustic and electric guitars. After an opening 4 or 8 bars, depending on whether you're counting the BPM as 72 or 144, Tom's vocals come in for the first verse. Let me roam with you tonight, I'll take you on a moonlight ride. He holds his vocal in check and lets the words float over that hypnotic beat. If you listen to the beat between the words too, I'm pretty sure you can hear an electric guitar being played completely palm muted and very percussively. It's mixed into the, I think it's the left channel, and it just adds a little rhythmic dynamism in counterpoint to that backbeat. There's a superb use of space in this song. So, and look, let's count the song at 144 beats per minute for the sake of consistency from now on. You'll notice, and we're talking about space, that the verses are 2 lines over 4 bars, followed by 4 bars without vocals, then another 2 lines over 4 bars, and another 4 instrumental bars. It really lets the song breathe and steep in its own groove. If you packed more words into this track, you'd completely lose that languid, unhurried vibe that it has. When the chorus hits, it doesn't lose that vibe by pushing into a big sort of grand explosion. It's more a subtle understatement. For starters, the bum bum cha beat becomes a straight backbeat bum cha. You have Howie Epstein adding harmony vocals, the clean toned electric guitar adding in the chords, and Ben Montench bringing more body with the electric piano. But it's all mixed tightly so that it doesn't interrupt the flow of that groove or detract from the brazenly open lyrics. Lyrics which, of course, got the song banned on MTV, VH1, and numerous radio stations. Now, there are a couple of different radio-friendly versions that were distributed that replaced the word roll with the word hit, and one that simply removed the word roll altogether. And I always find censorship funny and faintly ridiculous. Everyone knows what Tom's singing about. Everyone knows what the lyrics to this song are, as the album is already released at this point with the lyrics published. But as much as 1994 seems like recent history for some of us older folks, it's probably worth remembering that, you know, weed culture was still on the fringes of mainstream society in 94, so it's easy to see why execs got their knickers in a bit of a knot over this one. The title line of the song, though, when it comes, is such a great payoff. This isn't just a weed song, it's not a party song. In fact, apart from the title line, the rest of the lyrics really don't have much to do with that subject at all, if anything. You don't know how it feels to be me. There's a very deep profundity to that line that underscores the need, the ever-increasing need these days, for empathy. We're all quick to judge people, whether they cut us off in the fast lane or don't hold a door open for us as we're heading out of the grocery store. But We don't know what that person is going through, emotionally, psychologically, physically. And that disconnect is amplified a hundredfold when it's in the context of a famous person. Wealth and stardom and all the trappings of comfort don't mean much when your marriage is falling apart, for example. So you don't know how it feels to be me shouldn't be viewed as a dismissive wave of the hand. It should be viewed as an invitation to empathy. During that title line, once without and one with the end cap of to be me, we hear that really flanged out electric guitar in the left channel. Like Wildflowers last week, there's so much going on in this song, even though in your head, when you're not listening to it, it feels like it's stripped back to its various components. This is more true of the verses than the choruses, but even then, there are all these little flicks of the wrist and small daubs of paint that have been added in. The very short instrumental break after the chorus showcases those acoustic guitar chords, E, D, A. Oh, and by the way, there are really only four chords in this song, with a couple of passing chords thrown in here and there. But remember, in rock and roll, all you need is four chords and the truth. Five chords? Oh, that's damn near jazz. Of course, there I'm paraphrasing the great Lou Reed, who once said, one chord is fine, two chords are pushing it, three chords and you're into jazz. I mean, I disagree, but it's a good quote. In the second verse, we get more subtle flourishes from Benmont on the electric piano in the right channel, as well as Tom bringing that harmonica line back into the four non-vocal bars after each, you know, vocal four. There's something about the way he plays that harmonica too that's just, I find it very sweet. And I mean sweet as in endearing. He's not wailing on it like a blues harp player, or certainly it isn't mixed that way. He's simply letting it accent the two chord progression by descending down over it. And he always ends on the single note rather than the double. The second chorus runs through in the same way as the first, except that in the four instrumental bars that follow the chorus, we have Tom adding a little wailing on that harp. It's a really tasteful piece of playing, and it's easy to forget sometimes that Tom was a pretty accomplished multi-instrumentalist. Because on stage you basically see him playing rhythm guitar or in Mudcrutch bass, his ability on different instruments can sometimes be overlooked. And after this four-bar break, we get a little guitar solo, or guitar interlude, that's played by Tom rather than Mike. This solo section breaks down with a harmonica note taking us into the next verse. The instrumentation between vocal sections in this last verse has some grand piano added in, but it progresses in the same way as the first two, with those slightly different flourishes before heading into the last chorus, which has the title line repeated twice to take us into the second guitar solo, this time played by Mike Campbell. We then have the song ending as it began with that harmonica line before Benmont Tench wraps everything up with a lovely little bow in the form of a very, very cool electric piano lick to finish. Okay, folks, it's time once again for a little petty trivia. Your question from last week was this. The immortal line, most things that I worry about never happen anyway, from Crawling Back to You, was originally intended for which song from the Wildflowers sessions? Is it A, To Find a Friend? B, Don't Fade on Me? C, You Don't Know How It Feels? Or D, Somewhere Under Heaven? Well, as some of you likely knew, this was a sneaky little question because the answer is... today's track, You Don't Know How It Feels. In the home recording version that's included on Wildflowers and all the rest, the line comprises the entirety of the second verse. And while it does fit the rhythmic cadence of the song, there's something about that line that doesn't fit the lazy, carefree groove of it to me. The line really has to be in Crawling Back to You. And it does emphasize the creative process that most artists have where they'll cannibalize lines or licks from one song to fit better in another. And it takes a good ear to say, yeah, it's a great line, but I just don't know if it works there. I'll see if I can write something else and keep that for another song. Your question for this week is this. Very simple on this one too. Which is the shortest of the 15 tracks on Wildflowers? Is it A, Wildflowers? B, Cabin Down Below? C, Wake Up Time? Or D, Honeybee? Okay, back to the song. The lyrics in this one give the impression of being completely disconnected from each other and to an extent from the chorus. The first verse, let me run with you tonight, I'll take you on a moonlight ride. There's someone I used to see, but she don't give a damn for me. It seems to be sort of a first-person narrative with a failed relationship, the backdrop, against a flight of some kind with the third person. The second verse, people come, people go, some grow young, some grow cold. I woke up in between a memory and a dream. This one seems more reflective and wistful without being narrative in any real way. Then the last verse, my old man was born to rock, he's still trying to beat the clock. Think of me what you will, I've got a little space to fill. This one doesn't even feel internally consistent. The fact that his dad was born to rock but couldn't break the 9-to-5 routine is unrelated to the fact that the narrator is uninterested in your opinion of him or the fact that he has a little space to fill, but I think the cleverness of these individual abstract vignettes is that they're tied together by the first word of the chorus, but. The verse lyrics serve as a juxtaposition against the chorus, but let me get to the point. In other words, I'm just giving you random thoughts off the top of my head, all these random musings, but actually, what I want to say is this. Let's roll a joint and turn the radio up, maybe to tune out all the noise of life, because you don't know how it feels to be me. The title line didn't hit co-producer Rick Rubin at first at all. He supposedly worried that it might sound arrogant, with Tom assuring him that people would understand the context of it. And luckily, there was no serious discussion about changing that line, as the song would go on to become such an iconic one in Tom's discography. The music video for You Don't Know How It Feels won the MTV Video Music Award for Best Male Video in 1995. And I know that You Get Lucky, Don't Come Around Here No More, Into the Great Wide Open, and Walls, maybe, are the videos that people tend to go to when talking about the greats. But there's something about this one that's always fascinated me since I sort of fell, you know, headlong into the Pettyverse. For starters, I'd love to know how this one was shot. There are several really cool camera tricks that are used to give the impression of almost circular motion. It looks at times like the backdrop behind Tom is rotating rather than sliding sort of, you know, left to right, with him just standing in the center. And I think this is achieved by deliberately distorting the perspective of the backdrops in certain shots. There's also the pull and push of the camera to be close up or further away from Tom at various times that doesn't let you sort of sit in one position very, very comfortably. And I love how relaxed and casual he looks in a blue hoodie and a floppy hat with that barely suppressed grin. There are a couple of little moments in the video too that I hadn't caught until I started writing for this episode. In the third verse, when actress Raven Snow comes up to the mic to sing, she lip syncs the wrong words. If you watch, she sings, I got a little space to fill, rather than I've got a little space to fill. It's a small thing, but I think because of the nature of how I suspect this one was shot, they probably couldn't afford to go back and just reshoot that one piece. The other neat part is that at 3:45, you see Tom very clearly look off camera. And my guess is that it's either in response to the director or something that's going on in the background, you know, with setup or something. So what I think how this was done is that the backdrop is on a really long soundstage and Tom's on a platform with the camera, which is then sort of traversing left to right along that, you know, in front of that backdrop. So with the amount going on in some scenes, you know, we have shooting scenes, circus acts, barroom scenes, and a nod to Harold Lloyd also with the building front falling down, it would be really hard to retake specific sections and stitch them back together. My guess, therefore, is that the video is a single shot, which makes it very, very cool. Okay, for today's episode, I chatted to the wonderful Russell Mark from Pasadena-based The Next Doors after we sat down to talk about their latest single, Swing and a Miss, which I'd released a few weeks ago. Hopefully you enjoyed that episode, and hopefully you've had The Next Doors on solid rotation since. Anyway, here's our conversation about You Don't Know How It Feels. Okay, well, let's talk about You Don't Know How It Feels, second track from Tom Petty's second solo album, blew the doors wide open on Petty's career. We talked a little bit about Wildflowers the last time you were on, but we'll just recap a little bit. Like, this album to me, I mean, it comes out of nowhere in a sense. I mean, I was talking about this with John Paulson, that I think that Into the Great Wide Open was a big sea change lyrically for Tom, where he started becoming a lot more, very deliberate about trying to hone an idea across an album rather than just writing a collection of songs. But Wildflowers just takes it into this space that no one's expecting. Do you remember the album coming out?
Yeah, I do. And I remember, you know, hearing the song for the first time on the radio. And it you know, I was really surprised, I guess you might say. See, it's, I mean, everyone's experience is filtered through their own, you know, experience. So I just, you know, I happened to be, Wildflowers happened to be the first Hetty record that came out when I was in college. So it feels like a big change from high school to college. You know, in my mind, there's some connection there. Obviously, in reality, there's not.
Yeah.
But, I, you know, I guess the big single before that was Mary Jane, right? That would have been his last big radio hit.
Yeah.
And so, obviously, that was quite different than Into the Great Wide Open, but it sort of smacked of, obviously, it's a little bit Dylan-y. And, you know, if you're Dylan, Dylan-y is great. But when you're not Dylan, it does call into question a little bit whether someone is heading down a strange path, whether their voice isn't what it used to be, you know, all that stuff. Now, I really liked Mary Jane's Last Dance, but it was definitely, it was what it was, which is a track on a great hit. It was sort of like a song that you could just sort of, the stands on its own, I guess. And then the question was, you know, is the next thing that comes out going to be, I mean, up to that point, I don't think anyone filed Petty under classic rock, per se, because, you know, he was modern, he was 80s, he was charting the big hits, and the question was, is he now going to be sort of just filed under classic rock? And then Wildflowers came out, and the answer was ambiguous, I think. It wasn't clear.
Yeah.
But I remember hearing that song and thinking, like, now this is smart, you know, to, it was the right song to put out because it's different and it is very sparse. That's, I think that's the word you used. And
yeah,
it's very sparse and it's cool. You know, I mean, you, when Rick Rubin gets involved in something, you know that you're not just going to get the same album as the last one. There's no chance of that. And you know that you're not going to get something that's a total departure because that's not what he is. That's not what his credo is. His credo is to boil things down to the very essence of the artist and put it out in as unfiltered a form as possible. So you weren't going to get suddenly a symphonic album or something totally unexpected, but you do get it. I mean, that is the ultimate boiled down and distilled to the purest essence of the artist is you don't know how it feels. And it's, you know, much more overt than, I mean, I guess, see, again, I was in high school. I was, you know, I was just paying attention to high school stuff that for me didn't include drugs. So I'd never associated with Petty with drugs. And I don't know if anybody did in the 80s or not, but then all of a sudden this comes out and he becomes sort of this weed, you know, guy. He's suddenly in like that, the Black Crowes and the Grateful Dead and the, I don't know. I'll ask you, did you associate Petty with weed or drugs in the 80s or not?
No, I didn't really get into him until later. But even once I got into him later, I didn't. Because you don't, because the songs other than Mary Jane's Last Dance, which is a false attribution to marijuana,
right.
And then this
right.
one, which is an overt, you know, a statement about it in some ways. But I mean, again, though, it's funny that people latch onto that stuff, right? Like, you know, Hits from the Bong by Cypress Hill. Well, of course, you know, those guys are smoking
right.
weed all
right.
the time, which is great, fun, that's whatever. But Petty's using it, he's using it because it works in the song more or less. I don't think he's not sticking his flag in, right? Necessarily.
Well, necessarily, yeah, but it's definitely overt, you know,
in terms of
let's roll another joint. And then when I went to the Wildflowers tour and I just remember him, you know, he came out on stage and the first thing he says is that he's sober and people are, I don't remember what the reaction was. I'm sure it wasn't booing because and he says, "Hey, I didn't say I wasn't high." And then it launched into there. So I don't know. I think it was different.
Awesome.
Wildflowers was different. And that song was just, it's just super cool. It's a cool song and it's, you know, it makes you listen up. It makes you turn it up a little bit and listen a little bit closer. And it's, I don't think it was what was expected and whether it's more or less classic rock, it's hard to say, maybe a little more, you know. The second I saw the album art when I held it in my hands, then he's suddenly jeans and stubble and, you know, a shirt like yours. And it's like, oh, this does feel like an older artist and that he's embracing that. I think it was a big change. I think that was the first time that he was embracing being an older artist.
Well, it's an album that you can't write when you're 20. And it's an album that I don't think you listen to the same at 20 as you do when you're get it. Because I'm, like I said, I'm 50 now. You just listen to the content of these lyrics differently when you're that little bit older. But for me, this song, it's all about Ferroni's beat, man. Like it's all about that super simple, super stripped back groove that he gets going. And I love that story that this was the first thing he played, right? So Ferroni comes in, he's going to audition, he plays this. So you must, right. And I don't like talking down to people who don't, not musicians or whatever, but there is a difference. When you hear that, it's so simple. You think, well, anyone could play that.
Right. Yeah,
you can play the notes, but getting that just slightly behind the beat, making it just groove the way it does, as a musician, as petty as Ruben, they hear that and think, yeah, this is the guy. He's got it. He's got exactly where the roots of this is and where the heart of it is. Let's rip, you know?
Right. And of course, someone could be nervous and overplay, you know, But he's a guy who's a veteran player. And so, you know, not to do that.
Yeah,
and the sound, the whole sound of the record, of course, is very different. It's just the 80s is gone. And I would say that Mary Jane's Last Dance also. But this was a whole album now of a very different sound. I'm sure you saw probably the story. It was a Ferroni interview or something, too, where he was hitting the cymbals and the engineer and everybody was like, you know, for some reason, the drums sound great. But when you hit the cymbals, it's blowing up the sound in a weird way. Don't know why. But everything else sounded great. So Ferroni was like, cool, I'm not going to hit any cymbals and we'll go back. We'll do an overdub and I'll do the cymbals on an overdub. And then, you know, a week later or whatever, suddenly popped into his mind like, we never did it. We never overdubbed the cymbals. We got onto something else. And that's the way that it is on the record. And it's funny, I would never have noticed that. I mean, like, even as a, you know, as a semi-advanced listener like you are as well, it would never have occurred to me. But it's one of those funny things that you go back and listen, like, oh, that is unusual. You would normally hear crash cymbal from time to time in this song or any other song.
But it's that brilliant thing of, it's the same Keltner did that on Traveling Wilburys, right? When you listen to End of the Line, there's not a single cymbal hit on that entire song. Because it doesn't need it, so don't play it, right? So
I never noticed that one. See, now I'm going to have to go back and check
not
that.
One, because I did a cover of that with my friend. We're sort of still working on it a little bit. So I sat down and learned the drum part again. It's not a huge cut, but I was like, there is not a single hit on this. There's not a fill. There's not. It's just keeping that straight backbeat, which is, again, like you said, you bring in Kenny Aronoff, you bring in Steve Ferroni, you bring in a guy like Vinnie Colaiuta or something, you're going to get just exactly what the song needs 9 times out of 10.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, it's great.
But they can also deliver if you were to say to them, okay, now give me something really outside the box. They can do that, of course. And Stan Lynch can as well. Of course, I mean, you know, listen, be a very accomplished musician, producer, you name it. So,
absolutely, and that's something that when I talk to people who don't know the Heartbreakers, especially musician friends, I always tell them that both Stan and Steve are very musical drummers. You know, because there is a difference between someone, you know, like a pub rock band or somebody who's just doing sort of 80s hair metal covers. If it's just all four on the floor and it's all straight ahead, that's okay and that's fine and it's cool to be able to do that. But they add so much in the song just in very, very nuanced, slight ways that are very musical. And you have to have that musical ear. And I've talked to, I'm going to upset my friend Corey, who's definitely going to listen to this now. That's where someone like Lars Ulrich, who I've been recently listening to, doesn't seem sometimes to have that ear. It's like, that's just the wrong thing to play, or it's too much, or it's too little. You know what I mean? So
Right. Sometimes it's spot on. Like all those, the breakdown in one or whatever, that stuff, it's so good. But sometimes certainly overplaying can be a victim of overplaying. And I don't know about Lynch, but of course, Ferroni has a solid jazz background as well, which means that you're more studied. Yeah. You just are, you know, anyone who plays jazz drums has almost certainly taken extensive lessons in jazz drums, which exposes you to teachers and philosophies. And I mean, most rock drummers have taken lessons too, but I think there's more of a do your own thing, attitude there. Whereas jazz, you know, I think there's a lot of really learning fundamentals and such like that. And then using that to expand into other areas. Just the other day, and I thought it's one of those things where you see the ad on just a day late, but Ferroni was actually playing at this. There's like a dive bar up the street from here that has jazz a couple nights a week. And I would have obviously stopped in and checked it out, but I saw it a day too late. But, you know, he's one of those guys that'll do. I mean, we're talking like a dive, like that you might question whether you should take, you know, a parent to or not. And, and you know, it has legendary people playing in there sometimes, him being among them. So it's one of the neat things about, yes, being in LA, but also about people like him. And it's not necessarily the norm. There's not that many Hall of Fame drummers who just play anytime, anywhere they can.
And for the love of it, right? Just for the pure love of playing.
Yeah. Kenny Aronoff being another guy who it would never be a surprise seeing him play anywhere because he just wants to play.
Okay, so like you said, I mean, and obviously it's nice talking to producers too because he can get into the weeds a little bit on some of the stuff in it.
Yeah.
But the little, I remember Rick Rubin talking about the song Wildflowers and saying that, again, it sounds like a very simple song, but there's about 30 moments, what he called moments in that song. And there's little moments in this song too. And it's, you know, even just that flanged guitar tone on You Don't Know How It Feels, that little descending, it's so, you could play that on, you know, you could play a distorted tone there. There's any number of tones they could have picked, but that flanged tone gives it this width and it just punches home that line. It's such a clever bit of studio craft, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And the part itself always kind of reminds me of the breakdown or whatever you call it in American Girl. Actually, they have it almost seems like a little callback to like that part that you're talking about in the song. But yeah, that's right. You know, and you could say you can call it studio craft. But the truth is, with a band like that, it's no different than stagecraft. A lot of the time, they've been playing together for so long, and when you see them live, I mean, petty concerts are often, I mean, you know, I'd say to a fault, except for I don't think it's a fault at all. I mean, they sound so much like the records sometimes. It's just unbelievable for a band that you know for a fact isn't running any backing track or anything like that. I mean, these guys can pull out the tones they need when they need them. And the backing vocals are always so. I think, you know, in many cases, you know, busting out like that flange sound or whatever could be a producer saying, hey, why don't you try this? But as likely, it's just, you know, Mike Campbell knew what to do, stepped on that pedal, steps off of it when you're done. You know, it's definitely a recording philosophy to put every type of guitar sound that you're going to use in a song on a different track so that you can treat it differently. But I think it's probably more old school to be like, well, no, I'm going to step on my damn flange pedal. and then I'm going to step on it again when I'm done with that part. I'm not going to like put it on a different track. So, and I think that the Heartbreakers do pride themselves to a degree on keeping it pretty live in the studio.
Well, definitely when they get back, like you said, when they get back into Wildflowers, right? Because obviously working with Jeff Lynne, that was one of the frustrations that certainly Stan had, is he's very methodical and very construction sort of based, maybe is the right way of putting it.
Yeah.
But getting back in, like this album, even though we know, because we've seen the documentaries, was really labored over and was like multiple takes and lots of things, it does that have that organic feel still, because it does just feel like five guys in a room jamming this song out, which I'm sure the bed tracks would have been that, and then sort of overdubbed on top. But
and I'm sure there's overdubs, and I'm sure there's, because that's the beauty of making a record, is, you know, you make it however you want to make it, with whatever producer you want to make it with. You know, your bedrock should be the way that you want it to be, but then you're always going to be having ideas after that. Can we try this? Let's try overdubbing this, delete the guitar track, let me do it again, etc. And you don't necessarily talk a lot about all that stuff in interviews. So, you know, there's all kinds of stuff that goes into record making, and Petty is a guy who's really into record making. And I say record as differentiated from just album making, because not to care about the sound and to care about the nuances of the mix and all of that stuff, it's something you can hear in everything that they've ever done, which is not necessarily true for Springsteen or Dylan or some of these other guys. I think that they were just, that was 100% about the band and playing and the songs. And I don't think they focused as much. And I think that changed over the years.
Yeah,
but I don't think they focused as much at first on the art of record making, hi-fi record making. But you listen to that first Petty record, the drum sounds don't sound like, let's just throw up a couple mics and I'm sure that'll be fine. Whereas the early Springsteen records do sound like, let's just throw up a couple mics, I'm sure it'll be fine. But Petty was always pretty meticulous. So the fact that Wildflower sounds quite different and feels quite different is, of course, very intentional, down to the down to the choice of producer, the choice of studio, the choice of drummer, and all of that. And yeah, it's very different and certainly feels like a whole different journey. Yeah. Like you said, whether it, I've never done a truly deep dive into whether it is a concept album in some way, shape, or form that does truly connect everything or not, but it certainly feels very cohesive, you know, and it's a feeling that lasts from front to back. There's a certain vibe that doesn't really get interrupted.
Yeah, and the way that the drums are recorded, I mean, as a, you know, as a hobbyist drummer, I just love the way the drums sound in this record, but I also, as a hobbyist keyboard player, this is a song where there's a lot of piano on this album, but here, Ben Muntz, I'm pretty sure that's Rhodes, or it's definitely some sort of electric piano, right? Because it's got that timbre that you don't get typically from me. I'm sure you can process a piano to get that, but he's definitely playing that electronic piano. It's so slick. And again, that's what I always, with Ben Muntz, I always fascinated by. He knows, it's almost like the tone informs what he's going to play, rather than him thinking, well, I want to play this, I'll go, you know what I mean? So when you play a Rhodes piano, that's how that part's going to end up going. Whereas if you were playing it on a grand, you wouldn't roll quite as much. You'd probably just accent a bit more, be a bit more percussive maybe.
Yeah, and listen, there's been times when I've had an artist in and they're playing guitar and they say, well, I really, you know, I need a delay sound and a chorus sound. And I've said, well, yeah, no problem. We'll, you know, we'll do that in the mix. And they're like, well, no, I'm not going to play it the same if I don't hear it, you know, exactly the way it's going to be, because it affects your whole approach, whether you're improvising or not. Yeah. And so, yeah, those moments that you learn as a producer and as a musician, these things make a difference. Yeah. Yes. So exactly. If he was playing a grand piano, it's probably the wrong sound for the song, but a guy like that would make it work. It'd have to be different than what he's, you know, than what he was doing on the Rhodes or the Whirly or whatever it was. Yeah. And then of course there's the harmonica, which, again, you know, harmonica itself is just simply, and probably was, is never going to be a modern sound ever. It's always going to be an old fashioned folky sound. It's a, you know, it's a choice to use harmonica. And it's cool though. And I do think that's a big part of Rick Rubin, who's one of the kings of cool, using whatever it is he does to direct things in a way that keeps it real ambiguous, whether, you know, whether this record is modern or throwback, whether it's planting a stake in the ground that Petty is still as relevant as ever, or whether it's a stake in the ground that he's maybe a heritage artist, but he's not going anywhere. You know, it really is just a good album, you know,
yeah.
At the end of the day, like whatever, you know, whatever the impact that it had, that's the bottom line. But I think it was a very smart lead off single, because I mean, I don't remember exactly what was next. Maybe you wrecked me, but that is more overtly classic rock to me.
For sure, yeah. I mean, it's, I think You Wreck Me was the second single of them, because I think they released on It's Good to Be King as well, but you definitely wouldn't release that. You just wouldn't release that as your second single.
No, no. You know? And that's another, like, slightly out of the box kind of.
Yeah.
Cool. Yeah. Like, a interesting, cool, different type of affair. Whereas You Wreck Me is, it might be a good choice for first single, but not if you're trying to paint the picture that this album is, you know, something different that you haven't heard before. Because of course you're always going to have a combination. I mean, any writer who is writing for the love of writing and doing what they do naturally, you know, you're probably not going to have a completely different, unless it's, you know, unless that's the whole point, unless it's something like An Innocent Man by Billy Joel, where the whole point is, or the album that Beyonce just put out. Like, sometimes the whole point is, this is going to be an album in a different space from what I normally do, that intentionally has a whole different sound. But if that's not the case, then you would hope with any great writer, you're always going to have a combination of familiar, innovative, unique, and stuff that blends in and that could be comfortable in any era of that person's career, which is more like You Wreck Me, but You Don't Know How It Feels isn't, you know, that.
Yeah.
That one has the whole vibe is different than something you've heard before.
Well, it is a trick to get, because the album is fairly eclectic in terms of the types of songs that he writes and the types of arrangements and the instrumentation. And like you said, though, it still feels cohesive. Now, I was going to ask you, because you're talking about sort of hearing this song on the radio, but of course, you know, the iconic line, of course, is "Let me get to the point, let's roll another joint." But they took "roll" out on the radio edit, and it was "let's hit another joint,"
right,
which to me is hilarious.
Yeah,
it's hit great. It's still kind of got the same type of meaning, right?
So. Yep, it's a preposterous. If that was done for censors, then they did not do a good job.
Yes.
Yeah. But it's always fun, those little quirky things. And then, okay, where do you find that? And can you still find it? You know, anything like that, like how Lola has a version that's cherry cola and a version that's Coca-Cola. And like, even in this digital age, it's hard to like specifically look for certain things and find them without deep diving into YouTube.
Yeah.
So I haven't heard that "hit another joint" version in a long time, but I'm sure it's easily findable. But,
yeah,
you know, I just happen not to have heard it lately.
It's funny that, you know, as a fellow Kings fan, and I think we talked about that last time, I'd never, the whole cherry cola thing. I remember I'd known that song for about 5 years as a kid, because we had the album, of course, and the Kings' Greatest Hits album. But that had the Coca-Cola song. I'm like, "Dad, they're singing the wrong words." He's like, "Oh yeah, I was on the radio." I'm like, "But why?" "Well, I don't know the attitude." But why? No, stop asking why. I don't know.
yeah. Or I'll never forget how just like, what the hell did I just hear? The first time that they put out the original version of "Break On Through" by The Doors, you know, because it was always on the record. All I'd ever heard my whole life was "She Get," "She Get," and then they put out this "She Get High," "She Get High," and I'm like, "Holy crap!" I didn't know. I always thought it was just Morrison being Morrison. So "She Get," you know, it almost sounded like he was yelling "chicken" or something. I really didn't know it was "She Gets High" until they put that out.
Yeah.
Whatever it was, 20 years ago or 15 years ago.
Like, yeah, we're living in an age now where I don't think that happens really much anymore, does it? I think they would just take the word out, maybe, or like you said with the Morris thing, but it doesn't tend to happen these days because the streaming landscape has changed things and radio is not quite what it was. So there you go, kids. Go back and listen to some of these old songs that have got the lyrics changed just because they can avoid, you know,
but,
branding.
Or, that's right. But there's certainly, you know, they still have the censored and uncensored versions because, I mean, Taylor Swift and all, I mean, my God, three quarters of her last album, is, you know, has got the E on it for our language. So, I mean, definitely, you know, artists are still doing the radio versions, whether it's a bleep, but I think most of the time it's not. I think most of the time people are doing alternate lyrics these days. Yeah. So, you know.
What a pain, though, hey?
Which is, you know, the right way to go, I think,
because
you can't sing a bleep. It's no fun. You know, it's no fun to, you may as well just rewrite a little bit. So people can at least sing it.
Yeah, I just, like I said, I just love that kind of, it's such a petty thing to do, right? We'll just replace "roll" with "hit" then. You know, that gets us around the senses. Excellent. Let's leave that in. That's perfect.
Yeah,
and then you get this crazy video that is fantastic too, because it looks like a one shot. I don't think it's stitched in yet. You've got, it's, you know, the camera's obviously close up on Tom, but then you've got all this stuff going on in the background.
Yeah.
So to manage the choreography of that and the management of it, there's one part in it I noticed today when I was listening again, where you see Petty sort of break the fourth wall. He kind of looks off to the side and you can tell he's looking at the director or the producer or something's happened, and it just comes out of the moment for a second. But of course, if it is a one shot, you're not going to do the whole damn thing again if that's all it is, right? So.
That's right. Except for, I guess you could because everyone's there for. And well, I haven't watched that video in a long time, and now I feel like that would have probably been smart as part of my due diligence for our conversation today. So I'm afraid I have to apologize and give back some of the hundreds of thousands of dollars you're paying me to be here. It's only fair.
Hey, well, listen. Thanks so much for talking about this song. Because, like I said, I've taken on Wildflowers was a big deal for me. Like I feel like I've been waiting for this album the whole time I've been doing this podcast, and now it's right here. It's kind of scary because right I'm looking up at this monolith that is this album that I love, and I want to make sure I get it right. So trying to get people back in, especially musicians and people who work in studios and things, to kind of talk about these songs in a little bit more depth has been a hell of a lot of fun. So
yeah, and it's always fun to, you know, I mean, listen, how often do you, and when I say get to, I mean, we're all adults, you can do whatever you want, but how often do you get to just sit and talk about one song for longer than a minute or two? You know, most of the time when you do that, maybe you're hanging out with your buddies, maybe the album is on, and maybe you talk about that song for a minute while the song is on, and then the next song comes on, and then you're more likely to say something about that song than keep talking about the first song. So it's nice to talk about one song for longer than that song's length. And it's nice that people want to do that. And I can say as a songwriter that it's, you know, that you always think it would be nice if somebody was talking about a song I wrote for longer than 1 minute. So thank you for letting me do both. Which is talk about a Petty song for longer than 1 minute and one of mine for longer than 1 minute. The pleasure is definitely all mine.
So yeah, folks, don't forget to go back and listen to the episode that I threw up. We're talking to Russell about Swing and a Miss, which was the single that was released earlier this month when this comes out. I'm not too sure exactly what the dates look like right now, so we'll have to figure that out. But
yeah, March 28th. In the past. Thanks, Kevin. This has been a lot of fun.
Okay, Pettyheads, that's it for this week. As with last week, I didn't go back and re-listen to my conversation with Russell ahead of writing this episode, because already I know that it's going to be fun to see where my thoughts were, you know, where they were set going into my active listening for this episode, and where my guests maybe nudged me into different directions, either, you know, consciously or subconsciously. You Don't Know How It Feels is an anthem for pot smokers, to the extent that a Pettyhead would only need to say to another, hey, do you want to get to the point? And they'd both understand exactly what they meant. But aside from that, it's also a much-loved song in the discography and a song that I never tire of hearing, even though I've heard it at least a couple hundred times, you know, since I started getting into Tom's music. It's propelled by that superb, insistent drum beat, which is mixed immaculately and enriched by small licks and embellishments which never threaten to take center stage. The harmonica adds a distinctive personality in a much more relaxed way than it did on Mary Jane's Last Dance, and overall, this slow-moving stream-of-consciousness track has all the elements of a rock and roll classic and is why it stood the test of time. It has a great melody, a foot-tapping beat, and a memorable chorus. And clocking in at 4 minutes and 49 seconds, rather remarkably, it never feels long. I'm sure you're ready for a barrage of 10 out of 10s on this album, and I'm not going to tell you you're wrong at this point. This one is at the very top table for me and stands as a shining example of economy and simplicity in music made memorable by arrangement and performance. 10 out of 10. The Tom Petty Project is a proud member of the Deep Dive Podcast Network. Go check us out on Twitter at Deep Dive Podnet. I'm sure you'd find something there that you'd like. You can also check out my other podcasts, Seaside Pod Review, a Queen podcast that I do with my best friend Randy, as well as the Ultimate Catalog Clash that I co-host with the hardest working man in podcasting, Corey Morissette. Even though he's more of a cake fan than a pie fan. We probably shouldn't get into that here, should we? Anyway. Don't forget to follow me on Facebook, Instagram, Threads, and YouTube at The Tom Petty Project, and on Twitter at Tom Petty Project. Go follow, like, subscribe as applicable, and again, please leave a review or a rating if you haven't done that already. Keep talking to me on social media, and I'll keep trying to read out most of your comments on the show. And as a weekly reminder, The Tom Petty Project is not affiliated with the Tom Petty Estate in any way. So when you're looking for Tom's music, please visit official streaming platforms or go to your local independent record seller to grab some physical media. If you're looking for official merchandise, go to tompetty.com. And if you're looking for merchandise for this show, please go to tompettyproject.com. Don't forget to check out the Tom Petty Nation and Tom Petty Fans Forever groups on Facebook, if you're not already a member. They're excellent groups and they're fun hanging out in. Also, don't forget to check out Tom Petty Radio on Channel 31 on Sirius XM. Until we meet again next week, keep listening to and sharing Tom's music. Try to be kind. Try to say I love you to someone at least once a day. Stay safe and healthy, and I'll be back with you next week to talk about the achingly beautiful third track from this album, Time to Move On.
Bye-bye.